We're back. We're talking with Dr. Alan Radin, and the subject now is COPD and pneumonia vaccines.
We found, I think we continue to find, that many people don't know about the pneumonia vaccine. And for one thing, it's probably because the regular flu vaccine is given annually, and the pneumonia vaccine is every 5 years or twice in a lifetime, I believe.
Right. If you get flu vaccine, if you get pneumonia vaccine after the age of 65, you only need one dose. If it's given earlier than 65, then it's boosted in 5 years and then boosted again once after you're 65. We generally don't use much pneumonia vaccine under the age of 65 unless a person has a chronic illness which would make them more vulnerable to pneumonia, heart disease, diabetes, or any pulmonary disease. Well, those people ought to have pneumonia vaccine. After the age of 65, it's recommended that everyone get pneumonia vaccine. And this is pneumococcal pneumonia. It's one form of pneumonia. It's the most common bacterial pneumonia that we have, but it's that one form. It doesn't protect against all pneumonias.
Is it fair to say that pneumonia is one of the contributing factors to death of people that have COPD?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People with COPD die of pulmonary infections, oftentimes because they've been in and out of hospitals where there are, you know, pretty aggressive bacteria these days, resistant bacteria. So they frequently will have a more difficult pneumonia to treat. They've been in and out. They're weak. They have other illnesses. So pneumonia is certainly one of the end-stage diseases. And then also at that point, most of the people will have some heart disease. So that's another, you know, end-stage or end event.
Well, I know that Don wants to talk about cures or possible treatments, but I did have one other thing that I wanted to ask about.
Okay, Dennis. And it's your show.
Thanks. Oh, no, that was just that in my reading, I noticed that, and they said, surprisingly, COPD is a progressive disorder that cannot be cured, but older adults report fewer and less severe symptoms than younger ones. And they attributed that to a more sedentary lifestyle. What was the other reason that they...
I don't know, Dennis.
You didn't read the article.
That's...
Oh, second, they tend to grow accustomed to their symptoms and may restrict their activities to avoid them. So I guess younger people become
We're just impatient, Dennis. That's what it is. Okay. We younger people than you older people. Any new treatments on the horizon?
Well... why don't I talk about the treatments that are available now?
Okay.
So number one, beyond anything else, is stopping smoking. And there are a variety of ways that can occur. Some people just decide they're going to do it, and they go cold turkey, and they just get rid of the cigarettes, and that's the end of it. Others use some of the organizations, Smokers Anonymous, Smoke Enders. The hospitals in the area all have smoking programs or stop smoking programs to help people. There are medications that can be prescribed to help people avoid some of the cravings that can occur with smoking, because smoking is a nicotine addiction. It's an addiction to nicotine, and it's a very, very, very difficult addiction to break. So it often requires some help, whether it's through a group, whether it's some people do it with hypnosis, some people can do it themselves, and some people require medication. There's nicotine substitution in a variety of forms that is available, whether it be patch or gum or lozenge or sprays. So there are a variety of ways to help. It's very important for people to keep at it. If they fail one method, go to a second method. If they need to do it 10 times, that's fine. The national statistic is that it takes over 3 attempts to actually become a non-smoker. But if it takes 4, if it takes 5, whatever it takes, this is a life-saving maneuver. You know, it should be encouraged constantly by family, doctors, everybody. So that's number one. That's the most important thing. Nobody can beat the cigarette. The treatment for the disease, beyond that, you know, sort of general health measures, good diet, exercise, and such. And then there are inhalers. There are medications that can be used to help improve the lung function, to open up the bronchial tubes, which are now constricted by inflammation. Medications sometimes that are used to relieve some of that inflammation, inhaled medication to relieve some of the medications. So bronchodilators and inhaled medications to reduce inflammation are the mainstay therapeutic maneuvers that we have. Later on, we might add oxygen in late-stage disease, and there are certain criteria for doing that. Exacerbations, which are is an increase in the amount of sputum and the shortness of breath and the cough that people have, looks like an infection, like an acute bronchitis, then a person might get antibiotics. They might get oral steroid medications, prednisone, anti-inflammatory medicine, to help quell that acute attack. And then there's pulmonary rehabilitation, which is an exercise program and a program to teach people pulmonary methods for breathing better, for helping to relieve some of their shortness of breath. And that's available locally at the hospitals. At Norwalk Hospital has one of the premier pulmonary rehab programs in the country, and an early one that started very early and has a very excellent reputation. And so that can help people function despite the fact that they have the disease and perhaps are on treatment with some of the inhalers but still need some help in their life.
So we can be comfortable then.
There was an article that I also picked up from John Hopkins that talked about erectile dysfunction medicines as being tested as a treatment for COPD. Is that something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, it hasn't really panned out very very well. There was a recent article about that because it's been used in a different pulmonary disease, pulmonary hypertension, which has to do with the vascular supply to the lungs, and it's been used successfully there, but in COPD so far hasn't really panned out.
And then there was something else where they would perforate the air sacs?
Well, there are some surgical treatments for severe COPD. One is lung reduction surgery, which sounds counterintuitive that you would take out a piece of the lung in somebody that doesn't have enough lung function, but they take out part of the lung that is not functioning but is inhibiting the function of other parts of the lungs. A simple way to look at it. And
Makes sense. And
that helps some people. There's a bit of controversy of who is best served by that therapy. This is end-stage disease. This is people that have a hard time getting around their homes. They're on oxygen. This is a very end-stage disease. Most people with COPD, the vast majority, are not at that stage. They're at the stage where they're walking down the street and coughing every now and then.
Right. How did you get into this?
Some years ago, one of the pharmaceutical companies that produces one of the COPD medications contacted me. They put together an interesting program. They had half of a panel of nationally known COPD experts, and half the group were primary care physicians. This was called the National COPD Awareness Council. The purpose was to try to translate advanced knowledge about COPD that the pulmonologists would have and the bench knowledge to primary care docs and how best to get that word out, how best to educate the primary care community, which sees the most of the patients with COPD, and virtually all of the patients with early COPD are seen by their family doctors, their gynecologists, or their internists. So we worked for years, actually, and published a number of papers trying to bring that knowledge to primary care docs in a way that was feasible and reasonable for the way primary care is practiced all over the place. You know, short 15-minute visit, looking at the way patients present to us rather than the pulmonary specialists who are seeing patients in university clinics with advanced disease. I got interested in it.
You see the lion's share of people that are suffering from this.
Absolutely. We see all of the disease where intervention would make a huge difference. If we can get, you know, that 25-year-old smoker who now is mostly women, if you can get that 25-year-old smoker to stop smoking, you've saved somebody incredible misery. And we see those patients. The university pulmonologist doesn't see those patients. They see them when they're 60, 70 years old, and they're short of breath.
After everything that we know about smoking,
the problem with smoking, it's a rising problem amongst young girls for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is weight control. But that's where the growth in cigarette smoking is, and where the growth in COPD is.
Now, Dr. Radin, as the year progresses, if you have any lectures or presentations out in the community, please let us know.
I sure will.
And we will announce that.
We want to give a little bit of contact information to reach Dr. Radin. Again, he's with the Arbor Medical Group, which is in Wilton, Connecticut, and his phone number is
203-762-3353.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We will draw upon you in the future, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Once again, we're back to the differences between men and women.
In what form?
Well, in this particular case, making sure that we are equally studied and identified, I'll get that word out if I try, in the process of designing drugs and pharmaceuticals.
There was an article in Slate, and it was called Drug Problem, Women Aren't Properly Represented in Scientific Studies, and it was written by Melinda Moyer. And it was very interesting. Apparently there was a long article written by
a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern University by the name of Teresa Woodruff, and it appeared in as an editorial in Nature. And decades-long sex bias in biomedicine, which leads doctors to preferentially study diseases and test drugs in males.
Mm-hmm.
And Woodruff says this puts women at risk, and argues that it also limits the scope of our scientific knowledge.
Let's face it, women have been, we didn't have the vote for a long time as well. So finally we're getting some equality, or getting close to it.
There was an article in Genome Research that compared levels of gene expression in male and female mice. And this was very telling. They mm-hmm. found that 72% of active genes in the liver, 68% of genes in fat, 55% of genes in the muscle, and 13% of genes in the brain were expressed in different amounts in the different sexes.
Yes. Now, the discrepancies continue. For one very good telling example, I should try and say, is that women are three times more likely to suffer from an autoimmune disease as men.
But that is reversed in the case of autism. Mm. More men will have autism.
So that's surely another study that's going on somewhere.
Antidepressants tend to have a higher drug concentration, which I believe means more stays in the blood.
And that's why we're nicer.
Than men do,
mm-hmm.
Maybe. Half as much influenza vaccine for the same level of protection, although the dosage is always given in the same amount, men and women.
But Dennis, do you think this could possibly be a practicality in sending out the vaccine so that they would certainly have enough for everyone?
That would make sense.
Consideration?
Otherwise, they'd have to give two shots mm-hmm. to a man, which most men are such wimps, they have enough trouble
getting one. God, that would be fun. Could be great.
Drug concentrations in blood and tissues. There was a study that the FDA did over a period of 1995 to 2000, they studied 163 new drug applications, and they found that in 11 of those drugs that there was as much as a 40% variation in the amount of drug concentration that remained or was found in the blood of between men and women.
This really doesn't...
But it did not result in a bias towards sex dosing. It did not say that, given the fact of these studies, that whoever had the 40% difference was to be dosed differently.
Okay. But finally, see, we like to keep it really creative, Dennis. Just the whole structuring of women and how the ebb and flow of hormones progress for us.
Sure.
That's the reason.
All right. There was one other thing that they said, and that was women are more likely than men to experience adverse drug reactions. 8 out of 10 prescription drugs pulled from the U.S. market from 97 to 2001 caused more side effects in women.
But we have become much more conscious about the differences with the female body. Very simply, how long ago was it that you first realized when women are having a heart attack what the symptoms are and how different they are from men?
Well, because the symptoms that were being looked for were men's symptoms.
Right.
And so by the time they realized that a woman was having a heart attack, she was closer to death than a man.
Right.
And oftentimes she was less likely to survive.
To survive it, exactly.
And so now they're practicing with a different set of rules when they determine the potential for a heart attack in a woman.
And that information is fairly recent, that we've begun to really
it's very recent, actually.
You know, yes, to have it well publicized and documented to educate the public.
Now, where did this all come from? And according to the article, it's not malicious, it's lazy. Because males don't have a menstrual cycle, their hormones do not fluctuate much over time, making them more homogeneous study population and ensuring that the results are easier to analyze and interpret.
All right, I won't say anything.
Well, okay, don't. But the other problem was that in the 1950s, mm-hmm. there was an awful lot of adverse reactions, very serious adverse reactions to drugs that affected women who became childbearing.
Right.
And thalidomide is the one that is front and center here. And as a result, the concern became, what about women who might get pregnant?
Exactly.
So and down the road, someone who participated, and then 10 years later, they conceive, what might happen to the fetus.
The long-term effect. And we are a litigious society, and we also value our children and value the role of pregnancy.
So, in 1977, the FDA placed a ban on testing women who could become pregnant from participating in early-stage clinical trials. But the ban ended up applying not just to the women who could become pregnant, but to women who were not sexually active or women who were homosexual.
So pretty much almost the highest percentage of the female population.
Right.
So if you're a mouse, you were in.
That's right, but women, you were out. And so right. that law was upheld until 1993 when it was repealed. And part of the argument was that it implied a lack of respect for the female autonomy and decision-making capacity. Then in 1993, the National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act required that all National Institute of Health-funded Phase 3 clinical trials include women.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about the structuring of the female body, there's a higher fat content as well. When you think, we are totally different.
You are.
Fortunately.
And I think those statistics that we showed about the gene, the mm-hmm. percentage of genes in different genes in different parts of the body goes to show.
Mm-hmm. To testosterone or not.
When I was looking for, okay, you get past all of this and you've enacted a law that requires, then why is this still prevalent? And the article goes on to say, but the pro-male tendency lingered and has never been addressed by the FDA, which handles industry-funded trials, and many women who have since been included in trials have been required to ensure that they will not get pregnant.
Now, you and I have talked about this before as well, Dennis. There's so much fluctuation with childbearing females.
Mm-hmm.
So I somewhat have a bit of a slight understanding.
Well,
I can
appreciate it, and again, it's still back to God forbid that you participated in something and you signed on a stack of Bibles that you would never get pregnant, and lo and behold, you did, and
oops,
something happened, and mm-hmm. the pharmaceutical company, in its own defense, wants to make sure it doesn't get sued.
But the end result is we just don't have the refined or faster acting pharmaceuticals that we really should have.
Well, those will have to come through from studying mice.
I'll just more
right,
mice.
Well, okay, that's what we know about drugs, and you heard it here.
Here it is. Ear to the door news strikes again.
Okay, we're going to take our last break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about truth, testosterone, and women being shortchanged in clinical trials.